Chapter 54. Robert le Diable. The pretext of an opera engagement was so much the more feasible as there chanced to be on that very night a more than ordinary attraction at the Académie Royale. Levasseur, who had been suffering under severe illness, made his reappearance in the character of Bertram, and as usual the announcement of the most admired production of the favourite composer of the day had attracted an audience consisting of the very élite of Parisian fashion. Morcerf, like most other young men of rank and fortune, had his orchestral stall with the certainty of always finding a seat in at least a dozen of the principal boxes occupied by persons of his acquaintance. He had, moreover, his right of entry into the omnibus box. Château Renaud rented a stall beside his own, while Bouchon, in his editorial capacity, had unlimited range all over the theatre. It happened that on that particular night the minister's box was placed at the disposal of Lucien Debray, who offered it to the Comte de Morcerf, who again, upon his mother's rejection of it, sent it to Danglars, with an intimation that he should probably do himself the honour of joining the Baroness and her daughter during the evening, in the event of their accepting the box in question. The ladies received the offer with too much pleasure to dream of a refusal. To no class of persons is the presentation of a gratuitous opera box more acceptable than to the wealthy millionaire, who still hugs economy while boasting of carrying a king's ransom in his waistcoat pocket. Danglars had, however, protested against showing himself in a ministerial box, declaring that his political principles, as well as being a member of the opposition party, would not permit him so to commit himself. The Baroness had therefore dispatched a note to Lucien Debray, bidding him call for them, it being wholly impossible for her to go alone with her daughter to the opera. There is no gainsaying the plain fact that a very unfavourable construction would have been put upon the circumstances of two females going together to a public place, while the addition of a third, in the person of her mother's admitted lover, enabled Mademoiselle Danglars to defy malice and ill nature while visiting so celebrated a place of amusement. Thus, then, we perceive that for a mother, however innocent and pure-minded, to conduct her child alone to operas or spectacles would be deemed a breach of decorum, but to go thither under the guidance of one who, if not actually her seducer, might in time become so, made all right and set the world at defiance. Let others reconcile these strange inconsistencies if they will. We confess it above our powers." The curtain rose as usual to an almost empty house, it being one of the absurdities of Parisian fashion never to appear at the opera until after the commencement of the performances, so that the first act is generally played without the slightest attention being paid to it, that part of the audience already assembled being too much occupied in observing the fresh arrivals and noting each batch of élégantes as they take possession of their boxes to have eyes or ears for the business of the stage. While the noise of opening and shutting doors, with the mingled buzz of many conversations, effectually prevents even those few who would listen to the orchestra from being able to do so. "Surely," said Albert, as the door of a box on the first circle opened, and a lady entered, resplendent with beauty and jewels, "that must be the Countess G." "And who may she be, pray?" inquired Château Renaud, carelessly. "What a question! Now do you know, Baron, I have a great mind to pick a quarrel with you for asking it, as if all the world did not know who the Countess G was." "Ah, to be sure," replied Château Renaud. "I remember now, your lovely Venetian, is it not?" "Herself!" At this moment the Countess perceived Albert, and returned his salutation with a graceful smile. "You are acquainted with her, it seems," said Château Renaud. "France introduced me to her at Rome," replied Albert. "Well, then, will you do as much for me in Paris as he did for you in the Queen of Cities?"
"With much pleasure."
"Silence!" exclaimed the audience.
This manifestation on the part of the spectators of their wish to be allowed to enjoy the rich music then issuing from the stage and orchestra produced not the slightest effect on the two young men, who continued talking as though they had not even heard it.
"The Countess was present at the races in the Champ de Mars," said Château Renaud.
"Today?"
"Yes.
Bless me, I quite forgot the races. Did you bet?"
"Oh, merely a paltry 50 louis."
"And who was the winner?"
"Nautilus. I betted on him."
"But there were three races, were there not?"
"Yes, there was the prize given by the Jockey Club. A gold cup, you know. And a very singular circumstance occurred about that race."
What was it?
Silence! Again vociferated the music-loving part of the audience. Why, that it was gained by a horse and rider utterly unknown on the course.
Is that possible?
True as day. The fact was nobody had observed a horse entered by the name of Vampa, or that of a jockey styled Job, when at the last moment a splendid roan, mounted by a jockey about as big as your fist, presented themselves at the starting post. They were obliged to stuff at least 20 pounds weight of shot in the small rider's pockets to make him wait, but with all that he outstripped Ariel and Barbaro, against whom he ran, by at least 3 whole lengths.
And was it not found out at last to whom the horse and jockey belonged?
No. You see that the horse was entered under the name of Vampa.
Exactly, that was the title.
Then, answered Albert, I am better informed than you are, and know who the owner of that horse was.
Silence there!
Cried the whole collective force of the parterre, or pit. And this time the tone and manner in which the command was given betokened such growing hostility that the 2 young men perceived for the first time that the mandate was addressed to them. Leisurely turning round, they calmly scrutinized the various countenances around them, as though demanding some one person who would take upon himself the responsibility of what they deemed excessive impertinence. But as no one responded to the challenge, the friends turned again to the front of the theatre and affected to busy themselves with the stage. At this moment the door of the minister's box opened, and Madame Danglars, accompanied by her daughter, entered, escorted by Lucien Debray, who assiduously conducted them to their seats.
"Ha-ha!" said Château Renaud. "Here come some friends of yours, Viscount. What are you looking at there? Don't you see they're trying to catch your eye?"
Albert turned round just in time to receive a gracious wave of the fan from Madame la Baronne. As for Mademoiselle Eugénie, she scarcely vouchsafed to waste the glances of her large black eyes even upon the business of the stage.
"I tell you what, my dear fellow," said Château Renaud, "I cannot imagine what objection you can possibly have to Mademoiselle Danglars. That is, setting aside her want of ancestry and somewhat inferior rank, which, by the way, I don't think you care very much about. Now, barring all that, I mean to say she is a deuced fine girl."
"Handsome, certainly," replied Albert, "but not to my taste, which, I confess, inclines to a softer, gentler, and more feminine style than that possessed by the young lady in question."
"Bless my heart!" exclaimed Château Renaud,
who, because he had seen his 30th summer, fancied himself duly warranted in assuming a sort of paternal air with his more youthful friend.
"You young people are never satisfied. Why, what would you have more? Your parents have chosen you a bride who might serve as the living model of the hunting Diana, and yet you are not content."
"No, for that very resemblance affrights me. I should have liked something more in the manner of the Venus of Milo or Capua, but this chase-loving Diana, continually surrounded by her nymphs, gives me a sort of alarm, lest she should some day entail on me the fate of Actaeon."
And indeed it required but one glance of Mademoiselle Danglars to comprehend the nature, as well as justness, of Morcerf's remark. She was certainly handsome, but her beauty was of too marked and decided a character to please a fastidious taste. Her hair was raven black, but amid its natural waves might be seen a species of rebellion to the hand that sought to band and braid it. Her eyes, of the same colour as her hair, were richly fringed and surmounted by well-arched brows, whose great defect, however, consisted in an almost habitual frown, while her whole physiognomy wore that expression of firmness and decision so little in accordance with the gentler attributes of her sex. Her nose was precisely what a statuary would have chosen for a chiselled Juno. Her mouth, which might have been found fault with as too large, displayed teeth of pearly whiteness, rendered still more conspicuous by the over-redness of her lips, beside which her naturally pale complexion seemed even more colourless. But that which completed the almost masculine look Morcerf found so little to his taste was a dark mole, of much larger dimensions than these freaks of nature generally are, placed just at the corner of her mouth, and the effect tended to increase the expression of unbending resolution and self-dependence that formed the characteristics of her countenance. The rest of Mademoiselle Eugénie's person was in perfect keeping with the head just described. She, indeed, reminded you of the hunting Diana, as Château Renaud observed, but with a more haughty and resolute air than statuaries have bestowed on the chaste goddess of the silver bow. As regarded her attainments, The only fault to be found with them was the same that a fastidious connoisseur might have found with her beauty, that they were somewhat too erudite and masculine for so young a person. She was a perfect linguist, a first-rate artist, wrote poetry and composed music. To the study of the latter she professed to be entirely devoted, studying it with indefatigable perseverance, assisted by a schoolfellow who, having been educated with a view of turning her talents to account, was now busily engaged in improving her vocal powers, in order to take what she was assured by her friends she would infallibly attain, a leading position at the Academy of Music. It was rumoured that she was an object of almost paternal interest to one of the principal composers of the day, who excited her to spare no pains in the cultivation of her voice, which might hereafter prove a source of wealth and independence. But this counsel effectively decided Mademoiselle Danglars never to commit herself by being seen in public with one destined for a theatrical life. And acting upon this principle, the banker's daughter, though perfectly willing to allow Mademoiselle Louise d'Armilly, for so was the future debutante named, to practice with her through the day, took especial care not to compromise herself by being seen in her company. Still, though not actually received at the Hôtel Danglars in the light of an acknowledged friend, Louise was treated with far more kindness and consideration than is usually bestowed on that most unfortunate class of deserving females styled governesses. The curtain fell almost immediately after the entrance of Madame Danglars into her box. The band quitted the orchestra for the accustomed half-hour's interval allowed between the acts, and the audience were left at liberty to promenade the salon or lobbies, or to pay and receive visits in their respective boxes. Morcerf and Chateau Renaud were amongst the first to avail themselves of this permission. For an instant the idea struck Madame Danglars that this eagerness on the part of the young Viscount arose from his impatience to join her party, and she whispered her expectations to her daughter that Albert was hurrying to pay his respects to them. Mademoiselle Eugénie, however, merely returned a dissenting movement of the head, while, with a cold smile, she directed the attention of her mother to an opposite loge situated on the first circle, in which sat the Countess G, and where Morcerf had just made his appearance.
"So we meet again, my travelling friend, do we?" cried the Countess, extending her hand to him with all the warmth and cordiality of an old acquaintance. "It was really very good of you to recognise me so quickly, and still more so to bestow your first visit on me."
"Be assured," replied Albert, "that if I had been aware of your arrival in Paris and had known your address, I should have paid my respects to you long ere this. Allow me to introduce my friend, Baron de Château-Renaud, one of the rare specimens of real gentlemen now to be found in France, and from whom I have just learned that you were a spectator of the races in the Champ de Mars yesterday."
Château-Renaud bowed to the Countess.
"Were you at the races, then, Monsieur le Baron?"
inquired the Countess eagerly.
"I was."
"Well, then," pursued Madame G, with considerable animation, "you can probably tell me to whom belonged the winner of the Jockey Club Stakes."
"I am sorry to say I cannot," replied the Baron, "and I was just asking the same question of my friend Albert."
"Are you very anxious to know, Madame la Comtesse?" asked Albert.
"To know what?"
"The name of the owner of the winning horse?"
"Excessively. Only imagine—"
"But do tell me, Monsieur le Vicomte, whether you really are acquainted with it or no."
"I beg your pardon, Madame, but you were about to relate some story, were you not? You said, 'Only imagine,' and then paused. Pray continue."
"Well, then, listen. You must know I felt so interested for the splendid roan horse, with his elegant little rider so tastefully dressed in a pink satin jacket and cap, that I could not help praying for their success with as much earnestness as though the half of my fortune were at stake. And when I saw them outstrip all the others and come to the winning post in such gallant style, I actually clapped my hands with joy. Imagine my surprise when, upon returning home, the first object I met on the staircase was the identical jockey in the pink jacket. I concluded that, by some singular chance, the owner of the winning horse must live in the same hotel as myself, but lo, as I entered my apartments, I beheld the very gold cup awarded as a prize to the unknown horse and rider. Inside the cup was a small piece of paper on which were written these words, 'From Lord Riven to Countess G.'
"Precisely! I was sure of it," said Morcerf.
"Sure of what?"
"That the owner of the horse was Lord Riven himself."
"What Lord Riven do you mean?"
"Why, our Lord Riven, the vampire of the Salle Argentino."
"Mercy upon me," exclaimed the Countess. "Is he hurt too?"
"To be sure, why not?"
"And you visit him? Meet him at your own house and elsewhere?"
I assure you he is my most intimate friend, and Monsieur de Chateaurenault has also the honour of his acquaintance. But what makes you so convinced of his being the winner of the Jockey Club prize? Was not the winning horse entered by the name of Vampa? What of that? Why, do you not recollect? It was the appellation of the celebrated bandit by whom I was made prisoner.
True.
And from whose hands the Count extricated me in so wonderful a manner?
To be sure, I remember it all now.
Now, I argue from the circumstance of the horse and bandit bearing the same singular name that the Count was the person to whom the unknown horse belonged. But what could have been his motive for sending the cup to me? In the first place, because I had spoken much of you to him, as you may believe, and in the second, because he delighted to see a countrywoman take so lively an interest in his success. I trust and hope you never repeated to the Count all the foolish remarks we used to make about him. I should not like to affirm upon oath that I have not. Besides, his presenting you the cup under the name of Lord Riven proves his knowledge of the comparison instituted between himself and that individual.
Oh, but that is dreadful. Why, the man must owe me a fearful grudge for so doing.
Does his offering you the fruits of his victory seem like the conduct of one who felt ill-will towards you?
No, certainly not.
Well, then, and so this singular being is in Paris?
He is.
And what effect does he produce?
Why, said Albert, certainly during the first week of his arrival here, he was the great lion of the day. Nothing else was thought of or talked about but the wonderful Count of Monte Cristo and his extraordinary actions. Then the coronation of the Queen of England took place, followed almost immediately afterwards by the robbery of Mademoiselle Mars' diamonds, and two such interesting events turned public attention into other channels.
My good fellow, said Chateaurenault, the Count happens to be so great a favourite of yours that you treat him as carefully and delicately as though he were your best and most intimate friend. Do not believe what Albert's telling you, Madame la Comtesse. So far from the sensation excited in the Parisian circles by the appearance of the Count of Monte Cristo having abated, I take upon myself to declare that it is as strong as ever. His first astounding act upon coming amongst us was to present a pair of horses worth 32,000 francs to Madame Danglars. His second, the almost miraculous preservation of Madame de Villefort's life. Now it seems that he has carried off the prize awarded by the Jockey Club. I therefore assert and maintain, in spite of whatever Morcerf may advance, that not only is the Count the object of universal remark, interest, and curiosity at this present moment, but also that he will continue to be so while he pleases to exhibit an eccentricity of conduct and action which, after all, may be his ordinary mode of amusing himself as well as the world.
Perhaps you are right, said Morcerf, but just cast your eyes towards the box formerly belonging to the Russian ambassador, and tell me, if you can, who is the present occupant of it.
Which box do you mean?
The one between the pillars on the first tier. It seems to have been fitted up entirely afresh.
Did you observe anyone during the first act?
Where?
In that box?
No, replied the Countess. It was certainly empty during the first act.
Then, resuming the subject of their previous conversation, she said,
And so you really believe it was your mysterious Count of Monte Cristo that gained the prize?
I am sure of it.
And who afterwards sent the golden cup to me?
Undoubtedly.
Then do you know, said the Countess, I have a strong inclination to return it.
I cannot understand receiving such presents from a person wholly unknown to you. Do no such thing, I beg of you. It would only produce a second goblet formed of a magnificent sapphire, or hollowed out of a gigantic ruby. It is his manner of acting, and you must take him as you find him.
At this moment, the bell rang to announce the drawing up of the curtain for the second act. Albert rose to return to his place.
"Shall I see you again?"
asked the Countess.
"If you will permit me to make a second visit between the next pause in the opera, I will do myself the honour of coming to inquire whether there is anything in which I can be useful to you in Paris."
"Pray take notice," said the Countess, "that my present residence is 22 Rue de Rivoli, and that I am at home to my friends every Saturday evening. So now you gentlemen cannot plead ignorance both of when and where you may see me, if so inclined."
The young men bowed and quitted the box. Upon reaching their stalls, they found the whole of the audience in the parterre standing up and directing their gaze towards the box formerly possessed by the ambassador of Russia. Following the universal example, the friends perceived that an individual of from 35 to 40 years of age, dressed in deep black, had just entered, accompanied by a female dressed after the Eastern style. The lady was young and surpassingly beautiful, while the rich magnificence of her attire drew all eyes upon her.
"By heavens!" said Albert.
"'It is Monte Cristo himself with his fair Greek.'
The strangers were, indeed, no other than the Count and Aide. The sensation excited by the beauty and dazzling appearance of the latter soon communicated itself to every part of the theatre, and even ladies leaned forward from the boxes to admire the many-coloured coruscations that darted their sparkling beams whenever the superb diamonds worn by the young Greek played and glittered among the cut-glass lustres with their waxen lights. The second act passed away during one continued buzz of voices, one deep whisper, intimating that some great and universally interesting event had occurred. All eyes, all thoughts, were occupied with the young and beautiful female, whose gorgeous apparel and splendid jewels threw an air of insignificance upon all the fair visitants of the theatre. The business of the stage was utterly neglected. All seemed to consider the contemplation of so much loveliness far more deserving attention. Upon this occasion, an unmistakable sign from Madame Danglars intimated her desire to see Albert in her box directly the curtain fell on the second act, and neither the politeness nor good taste of Morcerf would permit his neglecting an invitation so unequivocally given. At the close of the act he therefore proceeded to the Baroness's loge. Having bowed to the two ladies, he extended his hand to Debray. By the Baroness he was most graciously welcomed, while Eugénie received him with her accustomed coldness.
"'My dear fellow,' said Debray, "'you have just come in the very nick of time to help a fellow creature regularly beaten and at a standstill. There is Madame overwhelming me with questions respecting the Count. She insists upon it that I can tell her his birth, education, and parentage, where he came from and whither he is going.' Being no disciple of Cagliostro, I was wholly unable to do this, so by way of getting out of the scrape, I said, "Ask Morcerf, he has got the whole history of his beloved Monte Cristo at his fingers' ends," whereupon the Baroness made you a sign to come hither, and now I leave the solution of her questions in your hands.
"Is it not almost incredible," said Madame Danglars, "that a person having at least 500,000 of secret service money at his command should possess so little information upon so everyday a matter as the present?"
"Let me assure you, Madame," said Lucien, "that had I really the sum you mention at my disposal, I would employ it more profitably than in troubling myself to obtain particulars respecting the Count of Monte Cristo, whose only merit in my eyes consists in his being twice as rich as a nabob. However, I have turned the business over to Morcerf, so pray settle it with him as may be most agreeable to you. For my own part, I care nothing about the Count or his mysterious doings."
"I am very sure no nabob of our time would have sent me a pair of horses worth 32,000 francs, wearing on their heads 4 diamonds valued at 5,000 francs each."
"He seems to have a mania for diamonds," said Morcerf, smiling, "and I verily believe that, like Potemkin, he keeps his pockets filled for the sake of strewing them along the road, as Little Thumb did his flintstones."
"Perhaps he has discovered some mine," said Madame Danglars.
"I suppose you know he has an order for unlimited credit on the Baron's banking establishment?"
"I was not aware of it," replied Albert,
"but I can readily believe it. And further, that he stated to Monsieur Danglars his intention of only staying a year in Paris, during which time he proposed to spend 6 millions. He must be the Shah of Persia travelling incog."
"Have you remarked the extreme beauty of that young female by whom he has accompanied Monsieur Lucien?" inquired Eugénie.
"I really never met with one woman so ready to do justice to the charms of another as yourself. Let us see how far she merits your praises," continued Lucien, raising his lorgnette to his eye. "A most lovely creature, upon my soul," cried he, after a long and searching scrutiny.
"Who is this young person, Monsieur Morcerf?" inquired Eugénie. "Does anybody know?"
"Allow me to state," said Albert, replying to this direct appeal, "that I can give you very tolerable information on that subject, as well as on most points relative to the singular person of whom we are now conversing. The young female is a Greek."
"So I should presume by her dress. If, therefore, you know no more than that one self-evident fact, the whole of the spectators in the theatre are as well informed as yourself."
"I am extremely sorry you find me so ignorant a cicerone," replied Morcerf, "but I am reluctantly obliged to confess I have nothing further to communicate. Yes, stay, I do know one thing more, namely that she is a musician, for one day that I chanced to be breakfasting with the Count, I heard the sound of a guzla. It is impossible it could have been touched by any finger than her own."
"Then your Count entertains visitors, does he?" asked Madame Danglars. "'Indeed he does, and in a most noble manner, I can assure you. "'I must try and persuade Monsieur Danglars to invite him to a ball or dinner or something of the sort, "'that he may be compelled to ask us in return.'
"'What?' said Debray, laughing. "'Do you really mean you would go to his house?'
"'Why not? My husband could accompany me.
"'But who knows this mysterious count is a bachelor?'
"'You have ample proof of the contrary if you look opposite,' said the Baroness, as she laughingly pointed to the beautiful Greek.
"'No, no,' exclaimed Debray. "'That female is not his wife. He told us himself she was his slave. Do you not recollect, Morcerf, his telling us so at your breakfast?'
"'Well, then,' said the Baroness, "'if slave she be, she has all the air and manners of a princess.'
"'Of the Arabian Nights?'
"'If you like. But tell me, my good Lucien, "'what is it that constitutes a princess? "'Gold, silver, and jewels, "'and our Greek beauty there is one blaze of diamonds. "'I doubt if any queens could equal them.'
"'To me she seems overloaded,' observed Eugénie. "'She would look far better if she wore fewer, "'and we should then be able to see her finely formed throat and wrists.'
"'See how the artist peeps out!' exclaimed Madame Danglars. "'My poor Eugénie, you must conceal your passion for the fine arts.'
"'I admire all that is beautiful in art or nature,' returned the young lady.
"'What do you think of the Count?' inquired Debray. "'He is not much amiss, according to my ideas of good looks.'
"'The Count?' repeated Eugénie, as though it had not occurred to her to observe him sooner.
"'The Count? Oh, he is so dreadfully pale.'
"'I quite agree with you,' said Morcerf, "'and it is in that very paleness that consists the secret we want to find out.' The Countess G insists upon it he is a vampire.
Then the Countess G has returned to Paris, has she? Inquired the Baroness.
Is that she, Mama? Asked Eugénie, almost opposite to us, with that profusion of beautiful light hair.
Yes, yes, there she is, cried Madame Danglars. Shall I tell you what you ought to do, Morcerf?
Command me, madam. I am all attention.
Well, then, you should go and bring your Count of Monte Cristo to us.
What for?
Asked Eugénie.
What for? "'Why, to converse with him, of course. "'If you have no curiosity to hear whether he expresses himself like other people, "'I can assure you I have. "'Have you really no desire to be introduced to this singular being?'
"'None whatever,' replied Eugénie.
"'Strange girl,' murmured the Baroness.
"'He will very probably come of his own accord,' said Morcerf. "'There, do you see, madame? He recognizes you and bows.'
"'The Baroness returned the salute in the most smiling and graceful manner.
"'Will!' said Morcerf. "'I may as well be magnanimous and tear myself away to forward your wishes. Adieu. I will go and try if there are any means of speaking to him.'
"'Go straight to his box. That will be the simplest plan.
But I have never been presented.
Presented to whom?
To the beautiful Greek.
You say she is only a slave?
While you assert that she is a queen, or at least a princess. No, no, I cannot venture to enter his box, but I hope that when he observes me leave you, he will come and take my place.'
"'We shall see. It is probable. Therefore go at once.'
"'Adieu. I sacrifice myself, remember that,' said Albert, as he made his parting bow.
As he had predicted, just as he was passing the Count's box, the door opened and Monte Cristo came forth. After giving some directions to Ali, who stood in the lobby, the Count observed Albert, and taking his arm, walked onwards with him. Carefully closing the box door, Ali placed himself before it, while a crowd of wondering spectators assembled round the unconscious Nubian. "'Upon my word,' said Monte Cristo, "'Paris is a strange city, and the Parisians are very singular people. Do pray observe that cluster of persons collected round poor Ali, who is as much astonished as themselves. Really, one might suppose he was the only Nubian they had ever beheld. Now I will pledge myself that a Frenchman might show himself in public either in Tunis, Constantinople, Baghdad, or Cairo,' without drawing a circle of gazers around him.
"'That shows that the Eastern nations have too much good sense to waste their time and attention on objects undeserving of either. However, as far as Ali is concerned, I can assure you, the interest he excites is merely from the circumstance of his being your attendant, you who are at this moment the most celebrated and fashionable person in Paris.'
"'Really? And what has procured me so flattering a distinction?'
"'What? Why, yourself, to be sure!' You give away horses worth 1,000 guineas. You save the lives of ladies of high rank and beauty. You send thoroughbred racers to contest the prize of the jockey club, the horses being rode by tiny urchins not larger than marmots.
Then, when you have carried off the golden trophy of victory, instead of setting any value on it, you give it to the first handsome woman you think of.
And who has filled your head with all this nonsense?
Why, in the first place, I heard it from Madame Danglars, who, by the by, is dying to see you in her box, or to have you seen there by others. Secondly, I learned it from Beauchamp's journal, and thirdly, from my own imagination. Why, if you sought concealment, did you call your horse Vampa?
That was an oversight, certainly, replied the Count. But tell me, does the Comte de Morcerf never visit the opera? I have been looking for him, but without success.
End of Disc 18. Disc 19.
Why, if you sought concealment, did you call your horse Vampa?
That was an oversight, certainly, replied the Count. But tell me, does the Comte de Morcerf never visit the opera? I have been looking for him, but without success.
He will be here tonight.
In what part of the house?
In the Baroness's loge, I believe.
Is the charming young female with her, her daughter?
Yes.
Indeed. Then I congratulate you. Morcerf smiled.
We will discuss that subject at length some future time, said he. But what think you of the music?
What music?
That which you have just heard.
Oh, it is admirable as the production of a human composer, sung by a party of bipeds without feathers, as Diogenes styled mankind.
Why, my dear Count, would you have me understand that you undervalue our terrestrial harmony, because you can at pleasure enjoy the seraphic strains that proceed from the seven choirs of paradise?
You are right in some degree, but when I wish to listen to sounds so exquisitely attuned to melody as mortal ear never yet listened to, I go to sleep.
Then why not indulge yourself at once? Sleep, by all means, if such be your means of procuring the concord of celestial sounds. Pray do not hesitate. You will find every incentive to slumber, and for what else but to send people to sleep with the opera invented?
No, thank you. Your orchestra is rather too noisy to admit the soft wooing of the drowsy god. The sleep, after the manner I have mentioned, and to produce the desired effects, absolute calm and silence are necessary, and a certain preparation must also be called in aid.
I know! The famous Hatchis!
Precisely. Now you know my secret, let me recommend you, my dear Viscount, to come and sup with me whenever you wish to be regaled with music really worth listening to.
I have already enjoyed that treat when breakfasting with you, said Morcerf.
Do you mean at Rome?
I do.
Ah, then I suppose you heard Aedes Gusle. The poor exile frequently beguiles a weary hour in playing over to me the airs of her native land. Morcerf did not pursue the subject, and Monte Cristo himself fell into a silent reverie. The bell rang at this moment for the rising of the curtain. You will excuse my leaving you, said the Count, turning in the direction of his loge.
What, are you going?
Pray say everything that is kind to Countess G on the part of her friend, the vampire.
And what message shall I convey to the Baroness?
That, with her permission, I propose doing myself the honour of paying my respects in the course of the evening. The third act had now commenced, and during its progress the Comte de Morcerf, according to promise, made his appearance in the box of Madame Danglars. The Comte de Morcerf was not one of those persons whose aspect would create either interest or curiosity in a place of public amusement. His presence, therefore, was wholly unnoticed, save by the occupants of the box in which he had just seated himself. The quick eye of Monte Cristo, however, marked his coming, and a slight, though meaning smile passed over his lips as he did so. Aedes, whose soul seemed centred in the business of the stage, like all unsophisticated natures, delighted in whatever addressed itself to the eye or ear. The third act passed off as usual. Mesdemoiselles Noble, Julie and Leroux executed the customary quantity of pirouettes. Robert duly challenged the Prince of Grenada, and the royal parent of the Princess Isabella, taking his daughter by the hand, swept round the stage with majestic strides, the better to display the rich folds of his velvet robe and mantle. After which the curtain again fell, and the spectators poured forth from the theatre into the lobbies and salon. The Count, quitting his box, proceeded at once to the box of Madame Danglars, who could scarcely restrain a cry of mingled pleasure and surprise.
"Welcome, Monsieur le Comte," exclaimed she as he entered. "I have been most anxious to see you, that I might repeat verbally those thanks writing can so ill express."
"Surely so trifling a circumstance cannot deserve a place in your remembrance."
"'Believe me, madame, I had entirely forgotten it.
"'But it is not so easy to forget, Monsieur le Comte, "'that the very day following the one in which you kindly prevented my disappointment respecting the horses, "'you saved the life of my dear friend Madame de Villefort, "'which I had placed in danger by lending her the very animals your generosity restored to me.
"'This time, at least, I cannot accept of your flattering acknowledgments. "'In the latter affair you owe me nothing.' Ali, my Nubian slave, was the fortunate individual who enjoyed the privilege of rendering to your friend the trifling assistance you allude to.
"'Was it Ali,' said the Comte de Morcerf, "'who rescued my son from the hands of bandits?'
"'No, Monsieur le Comte,' replied Monte Cristo, pressing with friendly warmth the hand held out to him by the general. "'In this instance I may fairly and freely accept your thanks. But you have already tendered them and fully discharged your debt, if indeed there existed one.' "'And I feel almost mortified to find you still revert to the trifling aid I was able to render your son. "'May I beg of you, Madame la Baronne, to honour me with an introduction to your charming daughter?'
"'Oh, you are no stranger, at least not by name,' replied Madame Danglars. "'And the last two or three days we have really talked of nothing else but yourself. "'Eugénie,' continued the Baroness, turning towards her daughter, "'Monsieur le Comte de Monte Cristo.'
The Count bowed while Mademoiselle Danglars returned a slight inclination of the head.
"'You have a charming young person with you tonight, Monsieur le Comte,' said Eugénie. "'Your daughter, I presume?'
"'No, indeed,' said Monte Cristo, astonished at the coolness and freedom of the question. "'The female you allude to is a poor unfortunate Greek left under my care.'
"'And what is her name?'
"'Aidée,' replied Monte Cristo.
"'A Greek?'
murmured the Comte de Morcerf.
"'Yes, indeed, Count,' said Madame Danglars. "'And tell me, did you ever see at the court of Alais-Tébélen, "'whom you so gloriously and valiantly served, "'a more exquisite beauty or richer costume "'than is displayed in the fair Greek before us?'
"'Did I hear rightly, Monsieur le Comte,' said Monte Cristo, "'that you served at Janina?'
"'I was Inspector-General of the Pasha's troops,' replied Morcerf, "'and I seek not to conceal that I owe my fortune, such as it is,' "'to the liberality of the illustrious Albanese chief.'
"'But look, pray look!' exclaimed Madame Danglars.
"'Where?'
stammered out Morcerf.
"'There, there,' said Monte Cristo, as, wrapping his arms around the Count, he leaned with him over the front of the box,
just as Aidée, whose eyes were occupied in examining the theatre in search of the Count, perceived his pale, marble features close to the countenance of Morcerf, whom he was holding in his arms.' This sight produced on the astonished girl an effect similar to that of the fabulous head of Medusa. She bent forwards as though to assure herself of the reality of what she beheld, then uttering a faint cry, threw herself back in her seat. The sound that burst from the agitated Greek quickly reached the ear of the watchful Ali, who instantly opened the box door to ascertain the cause.
"'Bless me!' exclaimed Eugénie. "'What has happened to your ward, Monsieur le Comte? She seems suddenly taken ill.'
"'Very probably,' answered the Count. "'But do not be alarmed on her account. "'Aidée's nervous system is delicately organized, "'and she is peculiarly susceptible of the odours even of flowers. "'Nay, there are some which cause her to faint if brought into her presence. "'However,' continued Monte Cristo, drawing a small phial from his pocket, "'I have an infallible remedy for such attacks.' So saying, he bowed to the Baroness and her daughter, exchanged a parting shake of the hand with Debray and the Count, and quitted the box. Upon his return to Aidée, he found her extremely pale and much agitated. Directly she saw him, she seized his hand, while the icy coldness of her own made Monte Cristo start.
"'With whom was my lord conversing a few minutes since?'
asked she in a trembling voice. "'With the Comte de Morcerf,' answered Monte Cristo. "'He tells me he served your illustrious father, and that he owes his fortune to him.'
"'Base, cowardly traitor that he is!'
exclaimed Aidée, her eyes flashing with rage.
"'He it was who sold my beloved parent to the Turks, and the fortune he boasts of was the price of his treachery. Knowest thou not that, my dear lord?'
"'Something of this I heard in Epirus,' said Monte Cristo, "'but the particulars are still unknown to me. "'You shall relate them to me, my child. "'They are, no doubt, both curious and interesting.'
"'Yes, yes, but let us go hence, I beseech you. "'I feel as though it would kill me to remain longer near that dreadful man.'
So saying, Aidée arose, and wrapping herself in her burnous of white cashmere embroidered with pearls and coral, she hastily quitted the box at the moment when the curtain was rising upon the fourth act.
"Do you observe," said the Countess G. to Albert, who had returned to her side, "that man does nothing like other people. He listens most devoutly to the third act of Robert le Diable, and when the fourth begins, makes a precipitate retreat."